Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. We live in a world awash with emotion. Protesters fill the streets to express their frustration, anger, indignation, grieved that the world is not as it should be. Theater trailers and TV advertisements do their best to mix the perfect emotive cocktail to persuade us to buy their product, movie, to believe their story. Behind 10,000 screens, an army of outrage waits to pounce on the smallest misspoken phrase. And those who do not float in this sea of emotion and desire sink. A fact which is confirmed by a recent study by Blue Cross Blue Shield that found that depression was rising in every demographic. It seems that we live our lives either caught up in the tsunami of the latest outrage or submerged in the gray waves of numbness, wishing to not be continually vulnerable to the volatile storm of the modern world. This leaves us with a pressing question. How do we make a lifeboat in the swirling sea of feelings? How do we experience emotion without becoming overwhelmed by it? What role does or should emotion play in our private and public lives? Or, as Mr. Rogers put it, more simply, yet not less profoundly,
what do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems so, so wrong, and nothing you do seems very right, what do you do? Do you punch a bag?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a brand new season of Speaking with Joy. I've spent the summer plotting and scheming, and I'm so excited to share this fall's episodes with you, beginning with this week's episode, The Army of the Emotions. This week, we'll be exploring the role of the emotions in our lives, how we can experience their depth and richness without being overwhelmed or controlled by them. This is a topic I'm deeply passionate about, as it's something that's a central concern of my doctoral research at the University of St. Andrews. This week, we'll start by looking at the literary example with St. Macrina, a wise woman of the 4th century, who talks about the emotions as an army that can accomplish great deeds, but can also destroy people. Then we'll be looking at the musical example with our good friend Mr. Rogers in his song, What Do You Do With the Mad That You Feel?, talking about the ways that we channel our emotions. And finally, we'll be looking at the visual example in the beautiful film, The Song of the Sea, one of my favorite films, talking about the fact that if we try to suppress our emotions, it'll turn us to stone. So we must learn how to experience the breadth and the beauty of emotion while also letting it not control or overwhelm us. At the heart of this episode is the idea that the emotions are one of the things that makes us human and are also an element of our personhood that can help us accomplish great, virtuous, and loving things. So I'm so excited to get started with this first episode of this new series. Now, as many of you know, I've just started a new program on Patreon that's supposed to be kind of a partner to the podcast. If you go on there, every month I will be doing newsletters that have something good, something true, and something beautiful based around a theme, but they also have discussion questions for all the episodes that I'll do. So if you want to use those, whether it's for your own personal education or to talk with others and kind of have a discussion guide, if you wanted to do a kind of a group with someone around the podcast, I'd really encourage you to go and check out that Patreon. It's $10 a month. You'll get that newsletter. You'll get a free PDF download of a little collection of essays I've put together for you all called Thoughts of Joy. And you'll also get secret podcasts. So you and all the other Patreon subscribers will get to have podcasts once a month or more than once a month that nobody else will get to listen to. And in addition to that, there's kind of a space on there for discussion, for you to engage with other listeners and people who are thinking like-minded thoughts. I really hope that this will be a resource for you, but I want you also to know that this really helps support me. I am currently, as you know, a PhD student, and I love doing these podcasts, but it costs me time when I could be doing something else. And but I don't want to give up on them. So you all supporting me helps me continue to do the podcast while also supporting my life while I'm doing research. So I hope you can go and check it out at joyclarkson.com. That's my website. You can find all the show notes and everything there. Or you can also just look on Patreon for Joy Clarkson. So check that out. And now, without further ado, let's dive into this week's episode, The Army of the Emotions. If a person uses the emotions according to the right principle, receiving them in himself without falling into their power, he will be like a king who, by using the many hands of his servants for assistance, will easily accomplish his virtuous task. Saint Macrina, On the Soul and the Resurrection. Macrina lived in a world very different from ours, but her wisdom has carried 2 millennia into our own. She was born in the early 4th century. She was the 3rd generation saint in a holy family of saints. Of course, she didn't know she would be a saint at the time, but her grandparents and her parents, and then many of her own siblings, became saints. Her grandfather was a martyr in the Great Diocletian Persecution, which is known to be kind of the most severe persecution of Christians before it was legalized to be a Christian in the Roman Empire. And her parents were also a very holy and influential family, who educated their children very well in the Christian faith, and many of their children became these kind of influential people. So Macrina is often known in connection with her family, so whether that's her parents or perhaps her brothers, two of which were Cappadocian fathers, Basil the Great and Gregory of Nyssa, and they're famous for formulating the Orthodox formulation of the Trinity. So when we talk about the Trinity of being of one substance, that comes from Gregory of Nyssa and Basil the Great. So Macrina is often kind of known in connection with these other people in her family, but she was a formidable figure all on her own. I got to learn about her, especially this year, because I learned about her for my PhD. I was looking for people who talked articulately about the emotions, and I came upon Gregory of Nyssa, and I started reading some of his work. And like I said, he's one of the Cappadocian fathers, who is a very important theologian in the early church. But what's interesting is that as I started reading about Gregory of Nyssa and his ideas on desire and emotion, Macrina kept on coming up, so I started to research it. And Macrina was Gregory's older sister, and she was actually responsible for his education. So in certain quotes, Gregory speaks about her in the highest of terms. He calls her his teacher. At one point, his father died when he was quite young, and Macrina kind of took up the care of the family with her mother. And Gregory calls her father, mother, teacher, discipler. So she was thought of in his mind as this very important person. And she was so important to Gregory of Nyssa that he even wrote a biography on her. I think it's called On the Life of St. Macrina. Now, you may be wondering, what does this have to do with the emotions? Well, when I stumbled upon one of the most important texts from Gregory of Nyssa on the emotions, he wrote a lot about that, the emotions and desire. One of them is called On the Soul and the Resurrection. And I found, as I started to read it, that it's actually written as this dialogue with Macrina. So it's written after Gregory's and Macrina's brother, Basil, dies. And Gregory is really just moved by this death, and he's really upset by it. So he goes to speak to Macrina, who, by the way, was in her monastery because she started this kind of monastic life with her mother after her father died, where they took care of the poor, and it was just this kind of incredible monastery. And that ended up being used as the model for the monasteries that Basil the Great started, which are the Greek Orthodox tradition. The monasteries they have and the monastic orders that they have were modeled on Basil the Great's. So Basil the Great modeled his on Macrina's. So yet again, Macrina's is kind of amazingly significant figure because she helped start even the monastic orders that we have in the Greek Orthodox Church today. That's an aside. Anyway, so Gregory goes to St. Macrina, who of course at that point was just his sister Macrina, to share in the sorrow of their brother dying. And to his great distress, he goes and finds that Macrina is also ailing and is also very old and is also dying. And he's just so sad. But he uses this little phrase in the opening of this book where he says, "She let like a good horseman, she let my emotions run, and then finally she reined me back in." And then he goes on to ask her, how can we have hope? And this may sound like, how does this connect to the emotions? But basically what he's saying is, what do we do with the fear of death and all of these emotions that come up? And so she starts to go through this kind of defense of the eternality of the souls, the idea that our soul will be eternal, and then talking about human nature and where our emotions come from and all these things. And they're all kind of connected for Macrina. And if you've ever read any Plato, you may be thinking, well, this sounds rather familiar. And if you haven't, let me educate you. So Plato has this famous piece, one of his most famous works is called the Phaedo, or the Phaedrus, and it's written basically surrounding the death of Socrates, and it's Socrates giving this education to his student about why he cannot fear death. And the reason that he's not meant to fear death is because he has an eternal soul. And in Plato's talk, he talks all about how our desires and our emotions that kind of pull us outwards remind us that we're made for something beyond simply our bodies. And you'll see this comes into play really interestingly with Macrina, that all of our desires speak to something beyond ourselves, and that something is the eternality of the soul, and that we will survive beyond physical death. So you might think that has some kind of similarities, and you would be right, because Gregory of Nyssa models this whole dialogue with Macrina off of Plato's Phaedrus, and in it he makes Macrina Socrates and himself the student, which I think just shows how intensely he honored and respected his sister, and really he truly did think of her as the teacher. So in this, she really gets into why do we have the emotions, and really how can we manage fear? And she comes up with kind of three things that we'll talk about today, and I'll give you kind of a preview of those. The first is that according to Macrina, we have emotions because we have bodies. Second, that emotions are good, and therefore bodies are good, because they draw us towards God. They remind us of our need for God. And then finally, that emotions can help us be virtuous. So let's kind of dive into what this looks like for Macrina. So she talks, let me read you this quote from the dialogue with her. She says, "Whatever faculties are proper to the rational nature are mixed with the intellectual power of our souls. From the animals is anger, fear, and all of the other qualities, except thinking power, which alone is distinctive to our nature. For we have, as we have said, in itself, the imitation of the divine character." So, let me unpick this. What she is saying is that according to Macrina, our soul is the bit that is the image of God in us. But we also have bodies, and we share in many ways these bodies that have a lot of things like animals. So animals are driven around by these desires for food, for shelter, for intimacy, even just for companionship. And so what she's saying here is that all of those things we actually share with animals, but that doesn't make them bad. Because according to Macrina, we are not just a soul. We are a whole person. So our nature is made up of our soul and our body, which makes up human nature when it's combined together. And she says, so why did God give us bodies like animals that have desires and needs and emotions? Why do we share that? And what she says is that we have these because all of these needs that we have remind us that we ultimately get our being from God. We need God. And so every desire and emotion, whether that's hunger or happiness at being with other friends, it's this reminder that we are ultimately created by a God, that we need him, and that he fulfills all of our needs. So having bodies is why we have emotions, because we get happy when we're with friends. We get sad when we're hungry. At least I know I get sad and I get hungry. Actually, it would be more true to say I get mad when I get hungry. But for Macrina, that's just this reminder that God gave us bodies as the sign of his goodness, that we need him and that he provides for us, and that all of the emotions we experience remind us of that need for him. So that's kind of her picture of the role that the emotions play in human nature. They come from the fact that we have bodies, and bodies always need things, and then once they have the things they need, they're happy. But that our bodies remind us that God loves us, that he created a good world to give our body things to enjoy, and also that our ultimate need is for him, because that's where our soul comes from. But then finally, she has this wonderful idea that the emotions can help us be virtuous. So there's this quote in it when, you know, they're having a dialogue back and forth, and Gregory says this to her: "We see that virtuous people receive no little assistance towards the good of those faculties, the passions. For Daniel's desire was praiseworthy, and Phineas placated God by his anger. We learn that the beginning of wisdom is fear, and we have heard from Paul that the end of godly grief is salvation." So what Gregory is pointing out, and what Macrina goes on to describe, is that a part of being a good or virtuous person is not just kind of disinterestedly knowing what is good. It's having these emotions towards the good. So she's saying that all of these people did virtuous things because of their emotions. And that's kind of based around this idea that when we're well-formed people, when our character and our virtue is formed properly, we'll have the right emotional responses to things. So when we see evil, we will be disgusted by it. We'll want to reject it. And when we see goodness, we'll want to celebrate it. And this is actually, what I love about Macrina is that it's very consonant with current moral psychology. So there's authors like Jonathan Haidt who researched how we develop our kind of moral sensibilities. And he said that much of the way that we relate to moral issues is based on a kind of gut affective response. And then we say, well, why do we have that? So if we see something terrible in the news, our first response is to go, oh, that's wrong. And then we think about why it's wrong. And that's what she's kind of saying, is that the emotions do most of our virtuous work for us. They're the thing that really start us off in the moral life. And so what becomes really important then is learning how to train them, how to cultivate the good and right affections, that when you see evil, you shouldn't like it. And that when you see goodness, you should love it. Makes me think of, there's a verse in Romans, I believe, where Paul says, you should cling to what is good and hate what is evil. It's a sense of our emotive relationship to what is good. And so it becomes really important that we form and train our affections. And of course, that's kind of a difficult thing to do, which we'll talk about later. But it's a difficult thing to do because our affections aren't really in the realm of how we can just think about it with our mind. So she gives us this analogy to think about how to train the emotions. And she talks about it like an army. And that was the opening little quote that I read to you. So she thinks about the emotions as this army, which if we're kind of acquainted with them and in control of them, then they can be the things that accomplish these great tasks of virtue. You know, if you're acquainted with your anger, and you are in control of it, you can channel that towards being someone who accomplishes justice. If you're someone who is acquainted with your sadness, but you're also in control of your sadness, you can accomplish that to send it out and to create sympathy and empathy and kindness to others who are suffering. So she sees that the emotions are this army that can accomplish great things, but it becomes important that we have to learn how to kind of direct it. Because the other thing she says is that if that army is not directed, if those emotions are not in their good lines and are not doing what they need to, they can become destructive to your own kingdom. So if you think of yourself like a kingdom, if your sadness and your anger and your joy and your desires are not well directed, rather than being the things that lead you towards virtue and towards a flourishing of what it means to be human, they can become the things that destroy you. And so it becomes really important for Macrina to learn how to direct the emotions and how to control them. And I don't mean control them in this kind of stoic way. You know, there were lots of stoics in this time. They said that we just needed to suppress the emotions and live out of our reason. So I don't mean that, because for her, it's important that we experience the emotions. And for her, it's kind of important that the emotions come to the surface so that we can actually begin to kind of have conversations with them and train them. And I think this all comes down to the idea of learning to be acquainted with our emotions and then direct them well and kind of be emotionally intelligent and self-regulating. And someone who helps us think about that really well is perhaps an unexpected character, Fred Rogers. So we'll wave adieu to our good and influential and wonderful friend, St. Macrina the Teacher, and pass it over to our good friend in the neighborhood, Mr. Rogers. Fred McFeely Rogers, better known as Mr. Rogers, was born on March 20th, 1928. He was an American television personality, a writer, a producer, a puppeteer, a musician, and a Presbyterian minister. He's best known for creating the television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. In a world when television was becoming sillier and faster and more violent, Mr. Rogers was famous for his slow, ordinary, and comforting television series that talked to children about their lives, their imaginations, what they learned, how to tie their shoes, and how to be good neighbors. I recently with my mom and brother to watch the documentary called Won't You Be My Neighbor, and I was absolutely moved by it. It's funny because I didn't grow up watching Mr. Rogers, but as I watched it, I was struck by what a legacy he left behind. Mr. Rogers spent his whole life promoting the idea that children matter, that they're loved, that they're accepted, that their worlds and their thoughts, their development, their learning, and their lives truly have a significance that sometimes we rush over as adults. And he did this by trying to create a program that got into the small and ordinary world by truly relating to children. And one of the most important things that he tried to validate was trying to figure out how to help children be articulate about their feelings and their emotions. Now, I want to play you a clip from a Senate hearing where Mr. Rogers was standing to defend the PBS to the Senate and try to get funding for it. This is a point where television was kind of new, and they were deciding what they wanted to give money to or if they wanted to give it to it at all. And I think this really kind of captures the vision that Mr. Rogers had for his program and for helping children understand and control and work and manage their emotions. So listen to this.
I'm very much concerned, as I know you are, about what's being delivered to our children in this country. And I've worked in the field of child development for 6 years now, trying to understand the inner needs of children. We deal with such things as the inner drama of childhood. We don't have to bop somebody over the head to make him to make drama on the screen. We deal with such things as getting a haircut, or the feelings about brothers and sisters, and the kind of anger that arises in simple family situations. And we speak to it constructively.
Mr. Rogers went on to defend the importance of this television show and the importance of having things that are slow, that teach children, that aren't just about entertainment, that are about entertainment and education. I love even how slowly he speaks. A lot of people have complained that the show is almost boringly slow. People say he couldn't really have been that kind or that slow or whatever. But I think it was all a part of his vision of taking children seriously. You could tell how absolutely seriously he takes the world of children and helping them navigate those feelings and everything that it is to be a child and to experience things for the first time. And you know, when he talks about the drama of childhood, I remember that, the newness of everything and the strength with which you feel feelings. I think sometimes we look at children, and this is really a sad thing, we look at children as almost less human. But children feel things profoundly, and actually the way that children are responded to, and this was confirmed by a lot of the research that he was drawing from, the way that children kind of learn from their parents to manage or experience their emotions kind of sets the tone for how they will experience them in the future, and also how they'll manage them in the future. There's this part in the documentary where his wife, who seems like an absolutely lovely person, who I would just love to have over for tea, she is talking about, she said that both she and Mr. Rogers came from families where feeling anger was something you were not allowed to do, or rather that you were not allowed to express anger. So it became something that was really scary and something that they didn't manage, they just had to suppress. But Mr. Rogers kind of overcame that in his older age, and he wanted to let children both experience emotions, but then also to know how to manage them. And I think that's demonstrated really well in this song that I already played you part of, but I'm going to play you the rest of it. And no, for the rest of the podcast, usually I will not have children's songs like this as our musical example. But I think this is such a profound and simple example of talking about how we experience emotions and also how we manage them. So when you listen to this song, think about how he's portraying emotion. He portrays it as kind of this force, kind of almost this, think of it like a wave that comes over you that's not to be stopped. And the question becomes then not how do we stop the wave of emotion or rather the force of emotion, but how do we direct it? And then how do we respond in ourselves when we feel overpowered by it? So let's listen through the entirety of this 1.5 minute song aimed at children that's really quite profound and I think applies to adults when we think about how do we experience and then direct emotion.
What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems so, so wrong, and nothing you do seems very right. What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag and see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a woman, and a boy can be someday a man.
What a cheerful little song, and also how profound. I want to pull out a few things that I think that kind of shine through in this song that actually have great applications to how we experience our emotions. The first thing he does is that he validates that children's emotional lives, and especially the experience of anger, is legitimate. Rather than kind of ignoring it or pushing it under the rug or saying, how do you stop your anger? He says, what do you do with it? The reality is that having an emotion is just like I said, it's like a wave. A wave is going to come over you. So the question is not, how do I stop this? It's what do I do with it? And so he validates feelings, but then he validates that suppressing them will never do away with them. So instead, we have to kind of look for an outlet for them. So he comes up with all these different ways of kind of using the, he kind of describes it as a force. So when you have the force of anger, what do you do with it? Are you going to get it out physically and go run as fast as you can? Do you punch something? And there's something actually I think really healthy, and I think this is true for me, of taking anger and not trying to suppress it or just say, oh my gosh, I'm so terrible that I have this, but channeling it somewhere else. But then the final thing that he does when he kind of turns the second part of the song is that he says, you have agency. Isn't it a great feeling? And he talks about this in the Cynic cover. He says, I want to talk about that wonderful feeling of control. Now, let's define what he means by this. I don't think he means control as in I can control how I feel, but the sense that I do not have to do the things that my emotions tell me that I'm going to do. So he gives children agency. He says, if your anger makes you want to hurt someone or scream or yell, you have the ability, the will within you to overcome that and not do that. And then he gives them this kind of vision that as you learn to do that, you'll become a lady or a man. And so it's this really simple thing, but I thought how profoundly important for adults to think about that. How often would it be useful for me, instead of judging myself or having an overwhelming surge of emotions, instead to think like Mr. Rogers, to first say, this emotion is legitimate, it matters, it's real. Second, that I should think about where I can channel it. If anger is not something I should unleash at people, how can I go for a run, release it somewhere else, listen to beautiful music, instead of trying to suppress it? But then finally, that I have agency over my emotions. They do not have to rule me. They can be something that I can choose to overcome, that I can choose to act in a different way. And I think this is such a wonderful kind of combination of his playfulness, his research in child development, and his real affirmation that your emotional life matters, but that you're also not controlled by it. But the tricky thing with emotions is that oftentimes telling ourselves that we're not controlled by our emotions doesn't do a bit of good. Sometimes we need something more indirect, more sneaky, to teach us how to feel about things. And our next example is something that helped me do that. So let us go on to the Song of the Sea.
Between the year, between the now, between the north, between the sorrow.
What do you do with a sorrow that you think might drown you? That is the rather ambitious question of this beautiful children's animated movie, The Song of the Sea, released in 2015. Now, a couple of months ago, we talked about The Secret of Kells, and this movie is done by the same production company. And what is remarkable about all of their movies is that they actually hand draw. So while a lot of animation studios, almost all animation studios now, work with digital artwork and stuff, they actually hand draw everything. And because of that, the whole look of the movie is just, it's so rich and pungent, and it looks this beautiful mixture of children's cartoons. It kind of is reminiscent of Miyazaki, but then also with this Celtic bent, because it's an Irish filmmaker, so you see these beautiful Celtic kind of symbols and patterns. You'll recognize it as soon as you see it. So it's just absolutely beautiful. One of my favorite films. But the question of the whole movie is really about sorrow. And it is about, what do we do with the sorrow that we think might overwhelm us? And I think that really ties in this whole question of, what do we do with the emotions? And for me, this film ties into it because I watched it at a time that I was trying to figure out what to do with some sadness in my own life. And I don't know that I would say that I was trying to figure out what to do, but rather that I was kind of at a place where I was trying to push down a lot of sadness. And watching this movie was really kind of redemptive, because it really weaves in how we can experience emotion and not be drowned by it in this really beautiful way, in this really gentle way. So let me tell you a little bit about the movie. It kind of exists on these two realms, and I wouldn't say that it exists in two different worlds, rather the worlds are kind of constantly breaking in on each other. And that is the kind of real world of this family, and it's a young father and his two children. And at the very beginning, you see him and his beautiful wife, and she's pregnant, and the little boy, the older brother, is so excited to meet the baby. And then something happens, kind of mysterious, and the mother seems to leave, but the father has the baby. And so you open the whole movie with this real kind of sad, mysterious event of, where did the mother go, and what's happened to her? And I don't want to give away too much, but what you realize from the opening is that the mother is a Selkie, which is this, in Celtic folklore, the Selkies were these kind of mythical creatures that were these beautiful women, but that could also turn into seals. And what would often happen in these traditional Celtic stories is that the Selkies would fall in love with the men on the shores, and they would want to stay and live with them, but then eventually they'd be called back to the seas and they would break the men's heart. So that's kind of what we see at this very beginning, is this heartbreaking moment where this loving father has lost his wife because she's a Selkie and she has to go back to the sea. And the story opens up on the birthday of the little girl. So the Selkie mother leaves right after the birth, right? So this is kind of a anniversary for him of this sad occasion. And the grandmother, who's not a Selkie, just the ordinary grandmother, comes and visits from Dublin, and she's convinced the children have to come live with her. Also, I forgot to mention that the children and the father live in this beautiful little island. They have to come live with her because she thinks it's not a good environment for the children. And so they go to Dublin, but they make this grand adventure to try to get back to the island. And as they go along the way, they meet all of these fairies. And they start to realize that maybe they're somehow connected with the fairy world. And they come to know this story, which also becomes important. And that's the story of Macha and her son. So in traditional folklore, Macha is this kind of Celtic goddess, and her son suffers this great sorrow, and he starts to cry so much. Her son's also a giant, naturally, and she is an owl. And he cries so much that he cries an ocean. So it's this image of this great grief. And so she hates to see him suffer. So not knowing what else to do, she turns him into stone. So this kind of becomes, you can tell, the imaginative image of the grandmother who takes him to Dublin, who loves her son so much that she thinks she can fix it just by kind of trying to cut off the remembrance of this sad day and do the practical thing. And so you can kind of see those relationships there. And what begins to happen in the fairy world begins to mimic what's happening in the children's emotional lives. So they find out that Macha is at her work again, and she's trying to turn all the fairies into stone because she's tired of those pesky emotions, as she says. And so it's really interesting how they depict it. They finally meet Macha, and she's this owl. And whenever she has a big emotion, she tries to put it into these little jars. And the jars that are full of the emotions are depicted as, whether it's a sunshine or clouds or a fire. And it's kind of these pictures of the emotions almost like weather, which, you know, we all experience emotions like that. And she does this, and every time she does this, she becomes a little bit more like stone. And so to save the fairy world, and also to get back to their father, they have to learn, they have to teach Macha to experience her emotions and to not turn everyone into stone. And I just thought, when I watched it was such a compelling vision to me of how we can respond to sorrow. Because obviously the father's sorrow is so great that you almost don't know what to do with it. And the children obviously don't know what to do with it. And really you're watching all of them experience this grief. And the grandmother, or Macha, the grandmother in the real life, and then Macha in the fairy world, she wants to just control it. She wants to ignore it and pretend like it doesn't exist anymore. But as she does that, she becomes heavier and heavier because she's putting away more and more of what it means to be human. And I think that's what happens when we steel ourselves against emotions. And we begin to lose everything that it was to be human to begin with. And it's easy to want to do that because we want to protect ourselves from sorrow. But what this movie kind of depicts is that to be human, to be alive, to not be turned into stone, we have to allow ourselves to experience the emotions. But the father, because he's never entirely let himself experience it, but he also hasn't totally grieved, he cannot move on with his life. He can't experience joy. And so there's kind of this depiction of the emotions as weather. That the solution for these characters is they have to learn to weather their emotions. They have to let the storm pass, the sun shine, you know, the hot day go on. And as they do that, they are able to turn Macha away from stone and begin to heal her. And sometimes that comes with great tears, but that, as Tolkien says, not all tears are bitter. And to me, I watched this at a time, like I might have said, when there was kind of a great sadness in my life. And like Macha, I kind of wanted to just ignore it, you know, kind of just push it to the side, become very practical, do what needed to be done, and move on. But when you do that, you begin to silence more and more all that makes you who you are. And a mentor of mine, I remember once, said to me, "Joy, the more that you have experienced sadness, the more you have a capacity for joy. And to stop yourself from feeling sadness is really to stop yourself from feeling joy as well." And that's kind of this image of Macha, the mother who hated to see her son suffer so much that she'd rather turn him into stone. And watching that kind of helped me unleash a sadness. And I realized that I needed to be sad for a while, but that was just like the storms that passed over Macha. And that eventually, if I let it pass, then I would not turn into stone and it would eventually pass. And that was really both a good argument to me for why I should let my emotions pass, but also it kind of helped usher me through that. And I think that what the Song of the Sea helps us see is that our emotions really are friends. They're helping us walk through and work through life. Like Macrina says, they are the army that can accomplish great and virtuous things. And we should not shoot down our army. We should experience them fully and beautifully. But just like Mr. Rogers says, we don't need to let those emotions sometimes control our lives. You know, the father in this is obviously deeply sad, but his sadness has seeped into his children's lives to a point where they can't be normal or live all right. And I think that that's a picture of Mr. Rogers' things, that we have to learn to some extent how to channel and express and even control our emotions so that we can live healthily, that we don't live at the behest of our emotions. But that in even trying to control our emotions, we ought also to let ourselves experience them fully, knowing that just like a storm, they will pass, or just like a wave, they will pass. We shouldn't waste our energy trying to keep the wave away from the shore, trying to keep the storm from passing overhead. Instead, we need to allow those storms to pass, those waves to come up over us, remembering that this is a deep part of what it is to be human, and that our emotions are actually our allies. And here at the ending, I think we bring ourselves back to what we began to discuss in the beginning. I think so many of our culture's problems stem from an inability to both experience and manage emotions. On the one hand, it seems like we're out of control of our emotions. If we live in a constant state of outrage, we begin to lose track of what things are actually outrageous. So I think we would do well to take Mr. Rogers' advice, to begin to learn what to do with the mad that we feel, to channel it, and to know that it is not the master of us. But when I look at the rising rates of depression and bits that I've experienced in my own life, I think we also need to learn how to grieve so that we might also learn how to rejoice. And I think that both of these lessons, both learning to manage, to control, and to channel our emotions, but also learning to let ourselves experience the fullness of them, comes down to thinking about our emotions not as an ocean that's trying to drown us or a foe that's trying to attack us, but rather as our allies in experiencing the depth and beauty in life, our allies, as Macrina would say, in accomplishing virtue, and our reminder that we were never meant to live life alone or in isolation. If Macrina is right and we have emotions because we have bodies, because of the sort of creature that we are, which is supported, like I said, by much moral psychology, then we have to learn to live into the pattern of that creatureliness. We have to remember that we are, in a certain extent, animals with souls, not robots. We need to experience emotions with others and to remember that God will never let us drown in those emotions. So I encourage you this week, whether it's a sorrow that you need to face or something that you need to rejoice in, let yourself experience an emotion to the fullest. Let yourself be human, be creaturely, and remember that your emotions are your allies and not your enemies.
The song of the sea, neither quiet or calm, searching for love again. Oh.
Thank you for listening to Speaking with Joy. If you enjoyed this episode, please go rate and review Speaking with Joy on iTunes, and also make sure to subscribe. You can find other episodes, show notes, and everything else at joyclarkson.com. And make sure to find me on Facebook, too, and also on Instagram and Twitter at Join Us the Brave.